Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the New Books in Theater podcast. I'm your host, Matt Freeman. Today, we are speaking with Martin Denton, the editor of the Plays and Playwrights series, and also the editor of NewYorkTheater.com. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to the New Books in Theater podcast. With me today is Martin Denton. Martin is the editor of NewYorkTheater.com and heads up the New York Theater Experience, Inc., I guess, and is the editor and publisher of a series of books that have been around since, I guess, 2001.
About 2000, actually.
2000, called Plays and Playwrights, where he chronicles some of the more the new plays that are coming out in the quote-unquote indie theater scene, what is known by many people as the off-Broadway scene. It's a new venture. Martin is a very influential guy in terms of bringing web coverage to the New York theater scene and covering a lot of the theater that kind of flies under the radar. And I'm really glad that you have a chance to talk with me today.
Well, thanks.
How are you?
Thanks. I'm glad that you asked me to do this. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. Nice to chat with you. Sorry not to see you in person.
Well, I'll see you in person another time, I'm sure. So to start with, why don't we talk a little bit about your background, what got you started covering theater? I know there's sort of a story that goes relatively far back.
Yeah, well, I guess the place it starts is in 1996 when I was still working for Marriott International, and I went to take an internet class. And at that point in time, the internet was still a very new animal. And so basically I was taking it just from the perspective of being a guy who worked in computer systems at Marriott who was learning about this new technology. And what happened was that I enjoyed the class a lot, and I thought, well, gee, I think I'll make a website myself so that I can practice how to do this. And I decided to make the website about New York theater because that's something that I love, although at that time it wasn't anything that I did professionally. It was just a great interest of mine. And so I built Martin's Guide to New York Theater. It debuted in November of 96. And in those days, as I said, it was the early days of the internet. Hard to remember that that was the case, but it was. And there really were very few theater websites in those days. And so it became popular pretty quickly, at least in the sort of niched area of people who care about theater and are interested in trying to figure out how to make the most of going to see theater in New York. And so within a very quick time, we got a lot of readers, and it became a full-time venture. I changed the name of it to nytheater.com in 1997. In 99, I actually left Marriott and formed the New York Theater Experience Incorporated, which is a nonprofit company that runs the website and does other things to try to promote in a tangible way the the work of theater artists in New York City. And pretty quickly, I don't know. Do you want me to, I'm going to segue into the story of the first book. Do you want me to do that, or do you want me to talk?
Oh, please do. Yes, absolutely. I'd love to hear. Yeah. Let's get started there.
All right. Well, I mean, that's kind of the next stop. I mean, NYTheater.com had been around for a while and was successful. And then in 1999, we embarked on our second major program, what it became the second major program of our nonprofit company, and that was the publication of books, of anthologies, of plays from the world of indie theater or off Broadway. And the way that really started was totally accidental. In the spring of 99, I saw a play called Are We There Yet? At the now defunct Synchronicity Space on Mercer Street in Soho. And it was a really nice play, really enjoyed it. And on the way out, I remarked to our managing director, Rochelle, who had seen the play with me, I said, you know, that was really a terrific play, and somebody ought to publish it, because otherwise it will be lost. The nature of the beast in the world of off Broadway is that after 16 performances in the Showcase Code production, the plays pretty much disappear. And unless somebody publishes it, it's pretty much gone forever. And so I just sort of had this passing remark. And then months later, at the end of 99, I said to Rochelle, I don't know why, but I did. I said, remember when I said we should publish Are We There Yet? We ought to publish a book. We should publish a book of new plays from off Broadway. And again, sort of for unknown reasons, Rochelle said, yes. You know, neither of us had ever published a book or had really an idea how to go about it. So we did. We contacted 8 playwrights whose work we had seen and liked over the last year and asked them if they'd like to join us in this crazy venture, and they all did. And Plays and Playwrights for the New Millennium was born from that. It came out in January of 2000. And the thing that was important about this was that at this period in 2000, right at the turn of the current century, publication of new American plays was pretty much a rare beast. If you weren't Edward Albee or David Mamet or somebody like that, Neil Simon, you know, one of the really, really prominent commercial playwrights, basically there was nowhere to publish you, with the only exception being the Humana Festival, you know, the new play festival in Kentucky every year. And they have a great record of publishing their participants' plays. But right. That was pretty much, if you weren't a superstar playwright or one of the people lucky enough to get in the Humana, you were pretty much out of luck as an American playwright.
Right.
Especially compared with, like, you look in Britain, where there's a great tradition of publishing plays. You actually, when you go to a theater, the play is almost always available to you in a paperback book that you can buy right there. And so we were sort of addressing that emptiness in the market, and it was as much my own personal interest, you know, just like, gee, I'd like to be able to read these plays, and I think others would too. And that was sort of the important discovery. When we did Plays and Playwrights of the Millennium, we discovered that there was an audience hungry for this work. And so this thing that started out as just really very much a whim became a major program of our company and an annual event, so that every year since, we have published a Plays and Playwrights anthology that presents some of the best new work that we've seen in the world of indie theater.
And this book coming up comes out when?
Yeah, well, we have a book that's going to come out in mid-May. It's probably around May 20th is when it will hit bookstores and virtual bookstores online. And
this right. You've just moved into e-publishing, trying that out as
yes,
well.
Yes, exactly. We published our first e-book about a year ago as a Kindle book, and then later brought it out as a Nook book for Barnes & Noble online. And we've now published the second one. Plays and Playwrights 2003 came out. We're basically bringing back the out-of-print books first.
Sure.
And Plays and Playwrights 2004 will probably be out by about May 1st or so.
Okay.
And then the new book, Plays and Playwrights 2011, which is our 12th annual volume, is going to come out simultaneously next month as both an ebook and a regular print book. And that's the first time we've ever done that. And we're really, really curious to see how that works out because,
yeah,
you know, you never know. What's nice about the ebook publication is that because the costs are lower, you know, we don't have to buy paper and books and things, you know, there's no money out the door. Exactly. We're able to, for the first time, offer the playwrights who are included a royalty. We used to just provide them with copies of the book, but now we can provide them with cash royalties based on sales, which I think they really like. And sure. We're happy to do it because, you know, we want, that's always been the goal of the series. I mean, one goal has been just to get the work out into the world, and we've been successful doing that. But it's also definitely to try to support these playwrights in some kind of tangible way, and money is as tangible as it comes. So.
That's true. I mean, I definitely find it interesting that, you know, some people just, I mean, there's a debate about what makes you a professional as opposed to an amateur, quote unquote amateur in the classic sense, meaning an enthusiast, even if you're highly skilled, are you a professional unless you get paid, so to speak? And obviously there is a lot of people working who, you know, there's just not, capitalism doesn't work for the arts in the way that I guess most people would like it to. And so sometimes you find that people are working at a very high, quote unquote, professional level and not really seeing an income stream. Do you have any opinion about what do you make a distinction between amateur and professional? Do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. I think about it in those terms. I mean, I think about it in a couple of ways. I mean, one thing is that certainly when we figure out what we want to put into the books, there's certainly a level of quality that we're looking for. I never thought to use the words amateur versus professional, but we only publish plays that have had productions. And so I think right away that sort of gets rid of a lot of what you might call amateur playwrights, because putting up a play, as you well know, is not an easy thing to do.
That's
so
true.
So that I really feel like that's an important criterion, because it means that, you know, and almost none of the people that we publish self-produce. So it means that somebody else in the world liked this play enough and cared about it enough to actually mount it and spend the money and spend the time. And so that makes me feel like that's a level of professionalism that we want to endorse reward, you know.
Absolutely.
Recognize. But then the other thing is this whole idea, like you said, of money equaling, you know, earning a salary or earning some money equaling that you're a professional. And I think that that's really important. I think that it means a lot to a playwright. I mean, we've had in several occasions, and actually only just the other day, one of the playwrights who is in Plays and Playwrights for the Millennium, which just became an ebook about a year ago, and we actually paid them their first royalty. And he said, "This is the first royalty I've ever received as a writer of my plays." He's actually a journalist, but he, you know, so he's been paid to do that, but as for his art, you know.
Right.
And that was really exciting. And I think he was really excited, even though it wasn't a huge check. He was really excited that, you know, hey, I'm being paid to do what I love.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you make a choice about what goes into the book, what's the criteria that you, is it just intuitive? You see lots and lots and lots of theater. Do you see everything you choose? Is some of it on recommendation?
Well,
or does the criteria sort of change? Or
you can cut this. The only play that I've ever published that I didn't see first was yours, and that's because we love you so much and we trusted you. We love the play, and it was right. It was a 9/11 thing because the play got canceled. I mean, isn't that why we didn't see it? Because it was going to happen.
No, it went on.
It was hard to get to or something, wasn't it?
It was just really cold.
Is that the reason why we didn't say? I knew there was an important reason why we couldn't go.
Full disclosure, I won't cut this. I think people should know, obviously, you did publish me. Full disclosure to people who read who read the book and who are listening to this. And my play that you published, it was my first publication of a play. It was The Death of King Arthur, and the production went up right after September 11th and was rehearsing during.
Yeah.
And we actually, the Times actually sort of scolded us for not realizing how cold it was.
Yes.
So that might have made it hard to come out and see, but I appreciated that. And but for the most part, you do.
I mean, the rule is we have to see it. I mean, we did make the one exception in your case, but we've been tracking its progress, and so I feel like we didn't make a mistake. I don't think we messed up on that one.
Well, thanks.
But the rule is that we have to see the play in production, and the other sort of official criteria are that it's supposed to be the first publication for the playwright, because that's really the key ingredient of what we're trying to accomplish. If a playwright has already got a publisher, then that's great. We're happy that they do. That's not our job. Our job is to bring playwrights their first point to publication, to really try to bring them to the next level. Basically, I always say we take people from being a completely unknown playwright to being a completely unknown published playwright. And And that's, you know, that's the first step, you know, because then you suddenly you aren't completely unknown. Suddenly, you know, I know that it matters. I know that when the Times decides what to review, being published matters to them, just to take an example, you know.
Sure.
It really is meaningful. So that's the most important thing. The other things that we use as criteria are more subjective, and they have to do with that. I always like to pick plays that feel like they're doing something. Either they're representing the time in a very clear and engaging way, so that they're representative of the period, or that they are. It could be and or they are doing something new, that they're changing the way we experience theater in some interesting way, or, you know, contributing some kind of innovation. And we try very hard, and I think we've gotten more conscious of this as time has gone on, and we've been aware that this is kind of an ongoing series, that I try hard to make sure that the plays that we pick look as much like the season as they can, you know, so that they, you know, so that there's a nice variety. You know, we want it to be a nice book that people will like, so we try to make sure that every year there's some comedies and some dramas and maybe a musical, maybe a solo show. And often, you know, sort of unusual things. We've published a puppet play. We've published a completely silent physical theater piece that has no dialogue at all. That was tricky.
what was that play called?
That was Bull Spears in 2005.
Hmm.
We published a lot of verse plays, such as yours and Kirk Bromley's, and a lot of things that I think are just sort of text, like Julia Barclay's Word for Your Mama. That was the first one of that nature where there's not even any characters or sets or anything you would call a traditional, you know, things you would expect to see in a traditional script are all missing. It's just a text that the director can play with, you know, in a sort of, you know, Mack Wellman-y, you know,
right,
sort of style. Just-
Yeah, that opens itself up to being interpreted by the director.
Exactly. And the thing that I find interesting is that very often in a book where that'll be the play that gets done the most, because directors are really looking for that kind of material that they can play with.
Sure.
More than just a fun traditional two-act, you know, play. Although we publish those too. I mean, again, we try to publish the spectrum of everything. We also try to be conscious, without quota system, we try to be conscious of diversity of various kinds, and we try to make sure that women are represented in every book, and people of color are represented, and, you know, diverse points of view in whatever way, you know. So
sure.
We, you know, hopefully a lot of different themes. I always say that I don't expect anyone to like all the plays in the book except me. But that ultimately is what it comes down to in the end, is that we don't publish a play that I don't like. We've certainly, over the period of time, come across plays that I thought were technically swell, but I just didn't care for the subject matter. I didn't like, you know, it just did rub me the wrong way. It's a purely personal, idiosyncratic thing, my book.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's one question I do sort of have for you is, do you feel like you come to... At this point, I mean, you've been involved in the indie, quote-unquote, theater scene, and I do want to discuss that term a little bit, and also seen so much work. Do you feel like there's an aesthetic you prefer, something that when you sit down and you're watching it, you know you're going to like this? Or do you try to just sort of say, okay, what am I looking at, and how does it succeed on its own terms? I mean, you must have... You know, your own taste. I mean, what do you think you bring to the table as a viewer?
Well, I think that my aesthetic is a combination of a constant hunger for new, something different and new. I mean, that's the main thing. So originality, whether it's some kind of theatrical innovation or just an original point of view, you know what I mean? I mean,
sure.
one of the plays in our current book really comes to mind. It's called Hassan and Sylvia. It's by a guy named Manny Agrijas. And the play is, in terms of its form, there's nothing at all unconventional or unusual about it. It's a very traditional sort of, you know, multi-character play where, you know, with lots of scenes. I mean, it's the kind of play that you would see, you know, structurally, there's nothing unusual about it. But what I loved about it, and the reason that I chose it, is because it looked at its subject and the world in a way that I'd never seen really in any art, because it's basically a play that in a very loving but unsentimental way exposes how everybody is a whore on some level. Fascinating concept.
Yeah.
And true in its way. I mean, a way of looking at the world that I thought was smart and interesting and that you don't see. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And not, you know, and I'm using the word whore because...
That's the word the playwright uses.
Yeah, exactly, but it's not... there's no judgment, and that's what I love about it, is that he was able to take this subject and say, here's something true about humanity, and I'm not judging it, I'm just presenting it as another way to look at a situation, you know?
Yeah.
And those are the kind of plays, I think, that appeal to me the most, where it's just a, you know, but I leave the theater and it's like, wow, I had never, you know, I've been seeing lots of stuff over all these years, and here's something that I just haven't come across yet.
Yeah.
So those are like the top things. The other thing, I mean, I love things that are sincere. I don't like cynicism. I don't like meanness. I don't like gratuitousness.
That cuts out a fair amount of off-Broadway.
Sadly, I think it kind of does. Yeah. But, you know, all that said, one of the things that this is developed into is it's definitely an important way for us to try to bring forward talented people that we think need to be brought forward. And so, you know, we rely a lot on our colleagues and friends and the people that review for us and just people like you, people that we've gotten to know, other playwrights, to help point us to say, hey, check out so-and-so, because this person looks really talented, and they're just at the very beginning of their career. And I make a point of doing that, and seeing people and saying, hey, here's this person who, you know, maybe they haven't written the perfect play yet, but they need to get some attention, so we're going to take their play and put it in the book.
One question I have for you, is obviously the site and the books in a way are a way of sort of reviewing the work in a professional way to give the work feedback, to be a critic. And but you also, the mission of the organization is to be an advocate, and there's an advocacy level as well. So a lot of journalists, quote unquote, or even, you know, editors for magazines or what have you, are very, very careful not to blend advocacy and journalism. It's sort of or that's a controversial thing to do. If you're going to blend advocacy and journalism, you better have a good reason for it. Or, you know, journalism is supposed to be as objective as possible, and critics try not to get personally enmeshed in the work that they're responding to. And that's really not your posture, as far as I've been able to tell. How do you sort of reconcile those things? Do you ever are you ever sort of questioned on whether or not you are, objective, or do you feel like it's not really your role to be objective?
Well, that's, you know, lots of good ideas there. You're so smart. let's try to sort it out. I mean, one thing is, I think that from my perspective, the journalism and NYTheater.com is the pure objective reportage, which is the listings, which is the main part of the site that people read, actually, in real life. I mean, it's always important to keep track of that, because the reviews take more time per show by far and feel personal, and we love them. But in fact, what most people come to the site to do, like half of them, just come to look at the listings and see what they're going to see tonight, you know, or tomorrow when they come to New York. And that's a really important goal of the site, and it's really important that the goals of journalism, you know, like accuracy and correctness, be met, because people rely on that information. And I think of the reviews as being just a wonderful feature on the site that, you know, as the site has grown, we've invited lots of people. Again, you included every once in a while. You will contribute a piece. And lots of people who know about the theater, who are theater professionals, who can speak knowledgeably about the work they see. And to my mind, you know, my reviews and their reviews are all just somebody's opinion about what they saw, designed to hopefully stimulate some conversation, provide enough information so that somebody reading it can figure out if they think they might want to spend the time and money on the show, and no more. I mean, I don't look at us as tastemakers or leaders in you know, trying to figure out, you know, what's going to be a hit or what's going to be successful. It's just a conversation. When I write a review, if I know the playwright or other artists, which is a lot of the time, it's always a conversation between me and them. I mean, I don't know if you've ever noticed that, but I mean, I'm writing to you if I review one of your shows.
Right.
The only person that I really need to read it is you. And it's not so much to give you constructive commentary. I'm really just trying to say back what I heard, because that's what I think is important. I mean, there's a lot of different things going on. One of the contributions I make reviewing somebody like any of the authors that I've published, you or Kirk Bromley or anybody that we've published that who does a lot of work, that I've pretty much made a point to follow everything they've done because I think they're important artists. It's really kind of a contribution to history more than to journalism. You know what I mean? I'm trying to create a body of here's somebody who's been here watching this artist grow.
Right.
Who got there earlier than anybody else, probably.
Right.
And so has a very different perspective. So I think that informs a lot of my reviewing, I think.
So it's sort of to because you've seen the work, you're not coming at any of the work that you're seeing as a blank slate. Now, that could be true of, let's say, Time Out. I'm sure David Cody over at Time Out, who's the editor of the theater at Time Out in New York City, he's very familiar with a lot of the people that are working off and is probably personal friends with some of them. But I do notice that he kind of goes out of his way not to review the shows of the people that he knows, you know, because that's sort of the professional standard and good on him.
I think I think that's good. It's just not what I do.
That's just not what you do, right? It's you just view yourself doing something else.
Yeah, because what you asked about, and I want to get back to the point is, I don't know, advocacy always feels to me like it might suggest something political, and I don't think of us as particularly ultimately political, except in that abstract way that everything is political.
Sure.
But I think what we're trying to do, the best quote that I think describes what we do is the quote that Kirk Bromley gave to Robert Simonson in a book that he wrote years ago,
mm-hmm.
Where he was writing about me, and Kirk described me as an engine of enthusiasm for the art. And
yeah.
I absolutely love that because it really felt like he got exactly what we're trying to do. I mean, we're all about encouraging people to see theater.
Right.
And if that means that, we're not always, distanced from our subject. Well, I mean, by definition, that's what it means, isn't it? We're distanced from our subject. We love theater, and we love the people who make good theater. And,
right.
And that's our job.
But distance
isn't
the only...
Other people will do other things.
Right. So, you've got your own point of view, and distance is not your paradigm.
Exactly. I mean, I think that... when I review artists who I know, I believe and hope, and I think that it's basically true, that they're going to be able to, they're mature enough and smart enough to know where I'm coming from if I do have anything critical to comment, and I think artists recognize the quality of their work.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I think that a good artist with integrity knows, this is my best work. This over here is not my best work.
Okay.
I think so.
You'd hope so.
Yes.
Or at least privately they think that.
Yeah, but they may not say
identify
it.
That. Yeah. So the books themselves. One thing I think is interesting is because you really were on the forefront and still are of theater, which is really an analog art, being represented digitally and covered digitally. And so I find it, intriguing that you would move over to saying, okay, so we're able to reach as many eyeballs as want to click on a link, but we think it's important to publish a book, which sort of the opposite thing is. So what about the physical book do you think is special to people? What is it that is it just the prestige of it, or is there something that the book for a theater artist provides them that digital can't?
Well, I guess when we started there really wasn't another paradigm for publishing a play digitally that would have been convenient, because basically in 2000, if we did publish it as an ebook, there were such things as ebook, but it was like the Gutenberg Project. You read it on a screen, on your computer. Maybe you could print it out, as it was formatted on the screen. It's hard to remember how different the world was only a dozen years ago, but it was like entirely different. I mean, now, because there are devices like iPads and iPhones and Kindles and Nooks and et cetera, then, there are many more mobile ways to carry your plays around that just didn't exist. So I don't know, if I got the idea today for the first
right.
time, I do not know that I would have even considered making a hard book. You know what I mean? I mean, it would
necessarily,
sure. I mean, the options now are different.
Right.
And so one of the reasons that we publish the book is because we publish books. You know, it's like lots of other things. And I think people like, I think what you said is also true. I think people like the physicality of it. People like to touch it and see it. And I mean, John Clancy, when we did the very first Plays and Playwrights for the New Millennium launch at the present company in 2000, he told the group, you know, how important he thought the book was because it was a, he called it a fetish, you know,
uh-huh.
in the sense of this is a thing, a physical object that we can now sort of say embodies the indie theater movement that did not exist before. And I think that tangibleness,
yeah.
Is really important to people. And it's interesting because as the series has progressed, and it has gotten to be reasonably well known, and at least within the world that you know, of indie theater in New York, where we travel, you know, people really, some playwrights really want to get in it. You know, it's like it is a kind of a prestige for them to say, you know, here's a milestone that I want to achieve. You know, that,
right.
that this book means something, and it's kind of cool to go to a bookstore or a library and see them all there. I mean, you know,
sure.
the way that it would never be cool. Although it is cool too, but it's a different feeling than when you go to Amazon and you say, "Oh, here are my books." But when you actually see them, you know,
yeah,
the physical presence of them is exciting, you know. And you know, to the extent that I mean, there's a couple of things that we just don't know yet. I mean, to the extent that books continue to be important in the world, and I don't know, you know, who knows in 40 years if there'll be books? You know, I don't know. You know, but I think it's still probably there will be. And then also just the fact that lots and lots of people who use the books to do some of their work, like to mount a play or to produce a play or act in the play or do a monologue or whatever. I mean, still they need the book, you know. They you know,
sure.
I think there are some actors who have learned how to use like their iPhone as the only source for their script, but I don't think that's the majority yet. I think most
no.
actors are still walking around with some kind of paper document now. So
yeah, I don't think you see a rehearsal room full of Kindles yet.
Not yet. I mean, who knows? You know, it's
yeah.
an interesting question. I mean, part of it is because the world are, you know, the main customers of our books, and probably theater books in general, are people who don't make a huge amount of money because they're actors or they're students, and those people, you know, don't all have Kindles yet necessarily. You know,
sure.
So, you know, but when it becomes more of a, you know, when Kindles are the same in terms of their popularity in the world as, you know, today, a smartphone is, you know,
right.
any kind of phone.
The
and
cell phone.
You know, I mean, everybody's got a cell phone, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time when a cell phone was evidence that you were rich.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I'm so old. I mean, I remember when I was in high school and I got my first Texas Instruments, you know, function calculator for like $200 or something. And that
right.
was like such a prestige symbol in school because who had like a portable calculator, you know? And, you know, but it's true. You know, I mean, the technology is, you know, it's not, we don't ever want it to drive us, but the technology does offer tremendous opportunities, and we want it's important to take care of them, you know, to
oh,
make sure we take note of them.
Well, it's true. I mean, one thing I think is key about the sort of publishing world from the critics' perspective, from the perspectives of reviewers and publishers, is that a lot of people who are viewed as sort of your counterpart in the New York theater world and probably broadly in the theater world are coming from publications first, meaning there's the New York Times was and always will be, or we think, first and foremost, a piece of paper,
mm-hmm.
a whole lot of paper. And then it created this web presence that is also omnipresent.
Yeah.
And that's true of Time Out, which is a magazine, and that's true of all the major papers in each town. But there is the sort of nouveau riche of the people who came straight up out of the internet first.
Yes.
who didn't come from publishing and then came to the internet because they had to be seen there too. They sort of went, but it's funny because it all sort of moves into the same direction. You've got a web presence and a physical presence, and they have a web presence and a physical presence, but they're just coming from opposite places. But do you feel like coming out of the digital world first has informed how you assess publishing, how you assess what your role is? Do you think that distinguishes you from the?
I really don't think so. But I think indirectly. I mean, I think that the thing that mattered in how it all came out was that what I learned when I started doing the online website, you know, the nytheater.com, was that the important place for us to make our contribution, and there's two sides to that, where we could be noticed and also where we were doing the most good, was to focus on the world of off-Broadway or indie theater, because mainstream publications that weren't on the, you know, that were in newspapers or magazines didn't pay attention to that stuff. And so, you know, it was a way that we could become more prominent in the community, but also it was a way that we could help people that weren't getting any notice. And I think that was the lesson that I applied to the book. I mean, as I said before, it's always about trying to get emerging artists some recognition for our books. And I mean, that was the important thing. I mean, when David Mamet makes a new play, he's on his own to get published. He doesn't have to come to me.
Right.
And he probably will get published. And even you, at your stage in your career, you've got a couple of firms publishing your work now, and that's why I'm not, you know, you don't really, it's not important for me to publish your plays anymore either, or anyone else who's reached the stature you have in the profession. Mm-hmm. We're constantly focusing on the new people.
Right.
Because they are the ones that need the attention. I mean, it's so hard to get paid attention to.
And what I think is kind of cool is watching the window between you publishing someone and they're getting more attention getting shorter. I noticed, like Mac Rogers with Universal Robots. It wasn't long after you published that play that. He got very great praise for Viral and started getting a little more attention and around town broadly for being very good at what he does. And Josh Conkle with Milk Milk Lemonade, which is now being produced all over the country.
Now, Viral is all Trumbull, though. I mean, let's not give credit where it's due.
Matt Trumbull is an actor, yeah. But Mac's a brilliant guy. But Josh Conkle, when did you publish Milk Milk Lemonade?
That was last year's book. That was in 2010.
Right.
So we caught him sort of right on the rise. And it was interesting because he was somebody who... it happened. The attention that started to follow came really right even before the book came out. I mean, he was really getting noticed, and it was really. You can ask him if he agrees, but it seems to me, from things he said and the way he behaved, that it was important for him to be part of the book. That he wanted to sort of be in the group, not group is not the right word. To be part of the little history that we've started with the book. If I can, don't sound too pompous there.
No. We wouldn't be talking to you if we didn't think it was important. So briefly, you also had added a summary of the year to the back of the book. Now, you only did that for a few years. There was a sort of an almanac, a theater almanac for what went on in indie theater. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you brought that in and why you discontinued it?
Well, the reason we did it was because, I mean, basically what it was a directory of all the new American plays that appeared in New York that we knew of, because I would never, ever suggest that we cut them all.
Right.
But it was a lot of them. It was a pretty good effort. And just to try to provide a record of them, because the main reference material that exists in the theater world, I mean, there's basically two references in hardback, in print. And one of them is the Best Play series, which has been around since well, really started in 1919, but it went, they did some back dating and went back to 1894. And then the Theater World series, which started in 1945. And those are both chronicles of all of the activity in American theater conceptually. They started at a time when you could do all of American theater by just covering everything that happened on Broadway, and then you'd pretty much be done, you know.
Right.
And that's no longer true. The response of the Best Plays books has been to try to make sure they cover as much as they can across the country, which is a huge, tall effort. And that happens at least a few, you know, it's less true now, but it was definitely, at the time that we got this idea, it was definitely at the expense of the off-Broadway world. That off-Broadway was getting only about 10 pages in those books.
Sure.
And yet contributing something like 90% of the new plays, even though most of them were not well-known.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was that we wanted to try to capture that, and it was also sort of wrapped around the idea of trying to invigorate and provide attention to this idea of indie theater, which I think is, you know, caught on, but is really important to maintain this idea that people understand that the really most important, most of the really most important new theater that happens in New York is happening in the indie or off-Broadway sector. And furthermore, that, and perhaps even more importantly, trying to dispel the misconception that indie theater is amateur or a bunch of kids goofing around or really avant-garde or really silly or really stupid or really confrontational. It's, you know, it takes into account everything. It's run through gamut, and mainly it's just most of what's out there, and most
right.
of the really creative, interesting stuff happens in that world. So that was part of the impetus. The reason that we stopped doing it is because paper costs so much.
Huh.
And it yeah. basically got to the place where to do it right, it was adding, you know, 50, 60, 70 pages to a book that, you know, of which 300 was plays, and now we're making it a 400-page book because we're trying to add all this information. And it's just, it's not really the mission of the book, we decided.
Right.
Now, we've been working, you know, I've been trying to figure out other ways to do it, and there's actually, I hope that by the time, if we do this again next year, that there'll be an online solution to this problem.
So, sure. Is there sort of a limit to the ability to archive?
Well, online, no. That's the beauty of it. I mean, online
yeah.
we can keep it. I mean, I really, I don't know if it caught your eye, but I mean, we introduced a new version of nytheater.com at the beginning of this year. And
yes.
one of the things that was included in it was the first steps of bringing back the archive. We brought back all of the Friends reviews. You know, we review every show on the Friends Festival every year since 2002. You've helped us do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the Friends reviews since we started doing that are now archived online, which was not true before. Now, that was really important because that's like, you know, a huge, that's 2,000 plays. That are now just there. And then we've also pulled back through 2005 of all our reviews. And I'm going to keep pulling back to try to get the rest of it up there. Now, obviously,
right.
we don't review everything that happens in indie theater, but it's a lot. I mean,
yeah, well,
700-800 plays a year. So
it couldn't be. It's a pretty close, I'd imagine, or at least it's the closest thing anyone's come. I mean, were you your organization was the first to review every show in the Fringe, yes?
Yes, we were the first and the only one that's done it consistently. We did it, I think we were up to 2002 was our first year, this is 2011, so this will be our 10th year doing it, and we did it this summer.
Wow.
10 years. And it's only been done, I assumed that in 2000, you know, we did it for the first time in 2002, and I was sure that in 2003 other people would do it.
Yes.
And then it didn't happen at all until Time Out did it like a few years ago, but I'm not sure that their approach was as serious as it could have been, and I don't think they did it last year.
Well, you know, it's you have a sort of volunteer army.
Yes, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Which is sort of, you know, it sort of feeds the site and the site feeds the army, you know,
exactly.
A little bit. So there's a symbiotic relationship between the artists and the content a bit.
Definitely.
Yeah. Which I think inspires people to get out there and help. So with the new book coming up, what do you envision for the future of the plays and playwrights books? Are you moving more towards ebooks or you're going to just continue on as you go? I mean, you did publish two two books that were not just kind of year-end reviews. There was the Mario Frati book and Playing with Cannons, yeah?
Yes, yeah, we did. Playing with Cannons was the first of those. We did that, and it's a book of 18 adaptations of works of literature or drama. And they were plays that either they were plays by people we'd already published that we really loved, or plays by people that we really admired and liked, but they didn't really fit the theme of the plays and playwrights books because, you know, they're kind of about new and fresh and exciting and, you know, and so adaptations always kind of feel out of place in there, although we have published some from time to time. So it was just a way to really collect some really wonderful material into a book. But I think, you know, unfortunately, I think we made a mistake. It's an oversized book. It's a heavy book.
It is a big book, yeah.
And I don't think that it's as appealing as I thought it would be, because I think one of the things that's great about the Blazing Playwright series is that it is just the size of a paperback. It's, you know, the kind you can sit on a chair and read, and, you know, it doesn't feel like a textbook. And so Playing with Cannons, you know, taught us a lesson about size, which is important. I'm very proud of it. It's got great plays in it, including one by Matt.
So, right, but in play publishing, size matters.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think so. And then the other play we did was Mario Frati, and that was really very much driven by his 80th anniversary. I mean, his 80th birthday. For people who don't know, Mario Frati is he's a playwright who's been working in the theater internationally for, I guess, by now, about 50 years. And he's very, very, very well known in Europe and in Italy, where he's from. Here, his major credit is that he was the original book writer of The Musical Mind, but he's written, like, you know, hundreds of plays. I don't think that's an exaggeration. He's tremendously prolific. And when we learned, as his 80th birthday was looming, that none of his plays were in print in America, except 9. It was like, well, gee, you know, we love Mario, and he's been a great supporter of our work. And so it was a really, you know, it's not something we would, you know, it was just one of those spontaneous decisions that you can make, you know, and said, we should publish this guy's plays and get the body of work out there. And it was really nice because we only just saw him on Sunday, and he said that he's really seen an increase in productions.
Oh, that's
that
wonderful.
It's really helped to get people to remind people, you know. I mean, it's, you know, we're a very fickle culture. And,
sure.
You know, if you're not, if you wrote 50 great plays, but the last one really was not successful. Last successful one was in 1980. You know,
right? You might as well.
You know,
where are they now?
You know, and so it's, you know, but it's great work, and you know, I wish, you know, in a way, I mean, we knew Mario well on it, and you know, his birthday made it an occasion. But you know, there's lots of people that, if resources permitted, I'd love to do that kind of thing for. But
yeah, what's the title of that book?
I was going to say the wrong word. Unpredictable plays, which is what
unpredictable
they are.
Unpredictable plays.
And they are.
Well titled. Do you have plans to, I guess my question is, you know, I mean, maybe you can't anticipate this, but do you have plans to branch out into other kinds of, you know, publishing anthologies like Playing with Cannons of different themes, or are you sort of happy, with the books as they evolve? You've constantly got new writers to publish.
Well, the thing that we're trying to crack next, and I think we're close to cracking it. I think that within months, something will surface, but it's nothing ready yet. So
teaser.
But basically, here's what we're trying to accomplish. The thing that we're trying to accomplish is to get plays to press. And when I say press, it might be online. It doesn't have to be in a book, or it could be both. But get plays out faster. One of the frustrations is that the annual anthology is that, you know, it's annual. So even if I see a book right now, if I see a play today that I love, it won't come out in the book based on our current cycle
until
for fully a year. You know.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that, you know, in 1999 when we started all this, I guess it didn't feel so bad, but now it's like a year, you know. That's an eternity in internet time, you know?
Right, yeah, that's true.
So time to market seems to be a really important thing. And so what we really want to try to solve is the problem of how do we get plays out there more quickly. And we're working on it.
Great. I'd love for you to talk a little bit you know, we're nearing the end of our time. I'd love to talk a little bit about the impetus behind pushing the term indie theater as opposed to off-off-Broadway. Off-off-Broadway obviously has a long tradition as a sort of label, as a brand. What inspired a desire to rebrand off-off-Broadway?
Well, the idea came... It was born the night of the first New York Innovative Theater Awards, which was in 2005, I think that's right. And the first winner of the Cafe Chino Award from the New York Innovative Theater Foundation was Kirk Bromley and the Inverse Theater. And in his speech, Kirk said that he wanted to propose renaming Off-Off-Broadway Indie Theater. And the analogies that he used, he said, I don't feel like I'm off anything or not something, you know, or, you know, I don't want to define myself by the thing that I'm not. I feel like I'm speaking for Kirk now. I feel like I'm an indie filmmaker. I'm the equivalent of that. Or I'm an indie music maker. That
right.
I'm making a kind of theater that has, that we're independent, is part of what we're doing, that is free from commercial structures and free from the things that we consider mainstream as opposed to indie. And I thought that he was dead right. I thought that his idea was absolutely correct and apt. And without really knowing it, I mean, he sort of made me realize that to call this part of the theater off-off-Broadway, I mean, it's only meaningful in a contractual manner. I mean, what off-off-Broadway is a thing that unions like Actors Equity define, and it defines places where you can perform and the contracts under which things can be performed. It doesn't really, when it started in the 60s, the off-off reflected anti-establishment, the way that a lot of what was going on in the 60s was, you know, anti-establishment, and so it was a badge of honor. But now I feel that Off-Off-Broadway is considered to just be, you know, kind of what it sounds like, not Broadway, you know, not even off-Broadway, but like so far off-Broadway that, you know, and that's a joke. You hear it all the time, you know, we're off-off-off-off-off-off-off-Broadway.
Right.
And it doesn't really mean anything. It does frame the art that people are creating, to my mind, in a negative way. Indie theater is a positive way to look at what people are doing. And I don't think that indie theater is necessarily narrowly constrained to being off-off-Broadway contractually.
Yeah.
It's lots of things that I see in lots of different theaters for Lindy, and lots of things I see in off-off-Broadway theaters don't. So
right.
It's really a state of mind.
If you felt, if it was just a rebranding of off-off, or if you feel like it's its own aesthetic, its own, if it has its own flavor.
I think it does. I mean, I think the thing that, to my mind, I mean, there's a couple of ways to look at it, and I mean, I think principally it really is a price point term. That indie theater is theater that people can afford, in contrast with most of Broadway and off-Broadway, which unless you get some kind of special or something or go to the TKTS booth, you probably can't afford, you know, because it costs hundreds of dollars. And what's important about that is not just that, not that you could afford it, but the fact that was the computer speaking. But what's important is that I think there's a lot of people who do not know that there is theater that they can afford to see. And here's a story to illustrate that. When Godlike Theater Company did a production of Slaughterhouse-Five a few years ago, 59 East 59th, it reminded me that I didn't have the book, so I went to a Borders to buy the book. And so I got my copy of Slaughterhouse-Five at the counter, and the young man, you know, probably about 23 or something, standing at the counter said, "Oh, I love this book." And so I said, "Oh, you know, there's a play of this book right now." And he said, "Really? I didn't know that." I said, "Yeah, there's a play." He said, "Well, that probably costs like $130, right?" And I said, "No, it's like $20. And he had no idea. And I think most people have no idea. I mean, we in the theater world, we know it. But the average person, when they think of theater, they think of Les Mis or Jersey Boys or Mamma Mia, and they know it costs a lot of money. And they don't realize that there's all this cool stuff, like Vampire Cowboy shows and Blue Coyote shows and, you know, Crystal Skillman shows and, you know, you name it. You know,
sure.
Stuff that, you know, isn't...
The Brick. I have to mention The Brick contractually.
Yes, I'm
sure you
do. The Brick
Theater in Williamsburg, yeah.
You know, but stuff that's not stuff that is genuinely fun and cool, and also you could actually afford to go to, you know.
Yeah.
That it's not like a week's salary by the time you add in the babysitter and the meal, you know. But
sure.
It's really just not that much more than a night of the film, you know, a night of the movies.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to get people to do. I mean, it really surprises me. I'm sorry if I'm going off on a tangent, but you.
No. I'm curious.
It surprises me how people will spend whatever it costs to go to a movie, $15 or something nowadays. I don't know, or whatever it costs to go to a band, you know, at a club, without
sure.
thinking about it. I mean, without blinking an eye. You know, oh, there's a new movie. Okay, you know, oh, it got terrible reviews. That's fine. You know, but
right.
the theater. It's like, if it doesn't have, like, testimonials and, you know, people, like, swearing it's good, people won't go. And it's often cheaper, you know. But, I mean, people, there's some kind of weird thing that, oh, theater, that's got to, I couldn't possibly spend $20 at the theater unless I knew in advance that it was the best thing I'd ever seen. I feel that all the time. I feel that there's this crazy, weird thing, and we have to break that because...
Yeah.
Theater is just this other fun way to spend a night out. Sometimes it's earth-shattering.
Like
most of the time,
feel like
it's not.
The liveness of it? Do you think the fact that the performers are in the space
exactly.
with you? Sometimes I wonder if what we're experiencing is just the anxiety of being in a room with other people, and it's a little more exhausting and taxing to watch other live human beings do something we don't enjoy than watching a two-dimensional screen do something where you could just eat your popcorn and walk out, you know?
I mean, you probably are right. But to me, I mean, especially as the world gets less and less connected, as it gets more and more connected, that wonderful paradox that we live
yeah.
through, you know, where you stand on an elevator and everyone is on their iPhone, not holding the door open as a result. You know, connection is really important. I mean, it's really important for us to gather. I mean, the best definition that I ever heard of theater is Chris Hopkins, who was in our first book, who said that for him, theater was an exploration of this phenomenon where a whole bunch of people gather in a room together and some of them act weird, and we try to figure out why. And I mean, that's a really fundamental thing to have to do, you know, to
yeah.
gather that way and to have that communal experience. When that experience... when it's good, as it is a lot of the time, such as at a Matt Freeman play, is the best experience that I know of. I mean, I honestly, I'm not just saying that. I mean, that's why I do this.
Yeah.
Because when it happens, there's nothing like it.
Well, that's fantastic. And I really appreciate you talking with me today. And I know that there are a whole lot of people who have been helped and inspired by the books that you publish and the work that you do. So could you remind everybody again when the next book is coming out and maybe talk about some of the plays in it and playwrights who are in it?
I would love to do that. Thank you. That was very nice what you just said, by the way.
Oh,
I appreciate it.
That's true.
Okay, so Plays and Playwrights 2011 is coming out in mid-May. It's got 8 plays in it. And I'll remember 7 of them. No, I'll try to get all 8. Okay, the plays in this book are Fault Lines by Rebecca Louise Miller, which is, do you want me to talk about, say what they are a little bit?
Feel free, yeah.
Okay, Fault Lines is a story about a reunion of 3 women who are probably around 30 years old, who have not seen each other at all, probably practically since an event that happened in their childhood that changed their life. And you'll have to read it to find out what that was. That's our
Great.
That's our hook. It's a fine, fine play. It's her first play, and she's it's amazingly mature and really wonderful writing. I mean, it's really just a terrific piece. So that's the first play in the book. The second play is Postmodern Living, which is by Richard Sheinmel and Clay Zambo. It premiered at La Mama. It's actually the second in a series that's called Modern Living, and it's about a performance artist who writes plays about his life. Not unlike Richard Sheinmel, who wrote it. And this play has 2 parts. The first part is about just a Christmas celebration, and I love that because it's a play where nothing happens, but everything happens, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
There's no real plot. Nothing really occurs. And then the second one has more of a plot. It's about his mother's discovery that she has breast cancer. And so it's but it's not, you know, I might have made it sound bad. It's serious, but never not funny. I mean, it's the kind of play where you laugh all the way through. It's got some songs in it. Really lovely piece. Third play is called G.I. Joe Jared, based on a really bad date, which is a comedy by Amy Whitting. And it's a delightful play about two young women who meet at a bar, and one of them is meeting her online blind date, who turns out to be a fellow whose talent is that he reads tarot cards. It's pretty funny. It's a cute story.
Sounds cool.
And then the next one is, what's number four? Number four is Love Me by Jason S. Grossman, which is it's a funny, fun story. It's the kind of play that if there's any God, a whole bunch of movie producers will be optioning it after they read it.
Because
you hate to use words because they sound cliche, but it's a feel-good romantic comedy. It's just this about a guy on a search for his soulmate, and, you know, I don't think it's spoiling much to say he finds her, you know, but it's, you know, the adventure, you know, over a couple of years. And it's got a lot of heart. It's just a fun, fun play. And very funny. He's a very funny writer. The next one is Hassan and Sylvia, which I talked about a few minutes ago. That's the play about this young man who falls in with a couple of exotic characters, and it turns out that everybody has a price. But it's not at all bitter. Like I said, there's no sentiment, there's no bitterness. Very clear-eyed, lovely piece. And then the next one is Floridita, My Love, which is by Javier Antonio Gonzalez, who is a young man from Puerto Rico who just graduated from Columbia, and Columbia University, not Columbia, the country. Very smart, and he doesn't like me to say that it's magic realism, but I ran out of ways to describe it. It's magical, yet it's realistic. It's a play about and probably illegal Latin American immigrant, and you know, it's mostly about paying attention to someone who is totally invisible in New York. You know, that waitress at the bodega or at the coffee shop who you pay no attention to. You know, we all do, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
You know, but let's find out who she is. So it's sort of like her life, and some of it's happening in her mind, and some of it's happening in life, and it's plays. You know, it's a playful piece. Really, really lovely writing. And then the next one is West Lethargy by Stephen Kolisky, and West Lethargy is similarly magical and realistic, actually a little less realistic. It's about two couples who are on a journey across America from east to west, who meet somewhere in the middle. And one of the couples is a contemporary couple looking for the brother of the woman. And the other couple seems to be living in the 19th century. So it's what happens to them. Interesting.
Interesting.
It is very interesting. It was in the Fringe Festival last year, and that's where we saw it. And he's a very promising young writer. This is also his first play. And then the book concludes with Endless Summer Nights, which is by Tim Erickson, who people might recognize as the artistic director of Boomerang Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Best known as a director, this is actually his first play to be produced. And it's a very grown-up, wistful, romantic drama about two characters, a man and a woman, who basically they were lovers when the last year in high school, that last summer before college, they'd fallen in love. And it's now 20 years later, and they haven't seen each other except she comes back to town. He's actually about to leave town for good.
Okay.
And so it's what'll happen. Are they going to reconnect? And
I know a lot of people who saw that play when it was performed in New York and were big, big fans of it, and really loved the showcase for the actors. Michael Criscolo was the lead in it, and people said that he did a terrific job. And I you know, so
yes.
I'm really glad that that's been published. I've heard good things, so I look forward to reading it.
Yeah, I hope you like it. I was very happy that we were able to publish that because, first of all, it's a good piece. But mm-hmm. Michael, who has been one of the most important supporters of NY Theater.com since we started it, worked for us for a long time in various capacities. It's the first time he's in one of our books as an actor, so I was
great.
Happy that we could stick Michael in there finally.
Oh, that's terrific. Martin Denton, I really appreciate you speaking with us today. I hope everybody seeks out, if they have not already, the Plays and Playwrights series. Look forward to hearing a whole lot more about it and reading all the plays.
Can we say a website where they can get more information?
Please do.
Yes, that would be nyte smallpress.com. And there you can find it all about the book, and there'll be interviews with all the authors published. Over the next month, that's the next thing's going to happen, and also links to how you can get the book to various places online or in stores.
Great. And that's New York Theater Experience, NYTE. Is it .org or .com?
Well, the book site is nytesmallpress.com.
Oh, got it.
The company's website is nyte.org, but you should go to nytesmallpress.com to get immediately find out about the books.
Great.
Instead
Great.
Of having to, like, press a whole bunch of buttons.
Right. Well, nobody likes buttons.
No.
We'll just put in the right. We'll put in the right address to start with.
Yeah, that's great.
Great. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It was absolutely great. Thanks for your insight. And thank you to the listeners for listening to the New Books in Theater podcast.
Thanks for listening to the New Books in Theater podcast. Check out all the great podcasts on the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. Thanks.